Hey, it's Max. Before we get started, I want to tell you about a new sponsor we've got on the show. I'm excited about this sponsor. It's Harry's. And here's why I'm excited. I do not like shaving. Shaving is not fun. I'm lazy. But also, razor blades are so expensive. Like, anytime I go to the drugstore and you got to go, like, get the guy to come over and unlock the case, and then you get the ones you want, and it's like $40 for six of them somehow, and it doesn't make any sense because it's just a little piece of metal. Harry's is here to solve that problem. They've got great razor blades at seriously affordable prices. I've been using these razors, so have Evan and Aaron. And I gotta tell you, we're looking pretty good. These Harry's razors, they give you a good clean shave. And if you want to try them yourself, you should use the starter kit. It's a razor, like a handle, three razor blades, and a tube of Harry's fantastic shaving cream. It's just $15. And that's such a good deal that Harry's doesn't normally like to discount their stuff. But for our listeners, they're willing to give $5 off if you use the promo code LONGFORM. So go to harrys.com, that's HARRYS.com. Use the promo code LONGFORM, start shaving better. Thanks, Harry's. Here's the show. Hello, welcome back, Aaron Lammer.
Hey.
How's that iced coffee?
I won't drink it on air, if that's what you're asking. I never would. I wouldn't even consider it.
Aaron's back. Good to have you back, Aaron.
Yeah, what's been going on in my absence, guys?
Tons of stuff. Too much to get into. But
yeah,
the episode this week is with Ben Smith.
Oh, of BuzzFeed.
Ben Smith, editor-in-chief of BuzzFeed, longtime political reporter before that. And we talked about like political horse trading. He also started like the first New York City political blog.
What New York City era was that?
Like 05, 06.
Yeah.
And then he was like at Politico, super early days of Politico, and then obviously has been at BuzzFeed in the early days of that as well.
So, it's a big operation now.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like it has grown under him. He started in 2012. He started like with the 2012 election. So we talked a lot about what those last 4 years have been like and how much he misses political reporting and lots of good stuff. Smart guy.
We're in kind of the feast end of the feast famine political reporting cycle.
Yes, for sure. A lot of good politics stuff out there at the moment.
Do they acknowledge, I know that BuzzFeed ran a story about sort of mocking Trump's presidential ambitions like a couple of years before. Do they acknowledge that as a potential cause for Trump's run?
Yeah, I think like many people think that it was that McKay Coppins piece. The guy who set it up, like Trump's guy who set it up got fired. Trump fired him. And there is definitely a potential narrative that that story drove him so fucking crazy that he decided to finally run.
We should get McKay Coppins on here to talk about that too.
Blame BuzzFeed. Blame BuzzFeed.
Like McKay Coppins will probably die if Trump gets elected, right?
Come on the show, McKay. We'll ask you.
How about sponsors?
I got a podcast recommendation for you guys. It's called Reveal. And each episode takes us into the hidden world or exposes a problem that most people know nothing about. The reporters spend weeks, sometimes months or years, getting to the bottom of a story. Along the way, they come across the most intriguing characters. Sometimes they're good guys, sometimes they're bad. But by the end, they've, wait for it, revealed what's going on and who's to blame. Check it out. You can find Reveal on any local public radio station, iTunes, anywhere you listen to podcasts.
I'm going to check that out. I'm also looking forward to Evan revealing what happens in part two of Mastermind.
Already up.
Go read it.
did not know that.
It's available to you right now.
To be fair, I had a discussion with Evan about that like 5 minutes ago where he did not mention that part two was available.
Blame Evan.
I blame Evan.
Blame McKay. Blame Evan.
I blame all of you.
Who wouldn't you blame, though? Who do you hold in the highest of esteem?
I would never blame MailChimp because when they say they're going to deliver, they deliver. MailChimp, it's simply the best way to run your business's email. Whatever your needs are, they've got you covered. Whether you're just getting a list off the ground or you have tens of thousands of subscribers, thank you, MailChimp.
And now here's Max with Ben Smith from BuzzFeed.
Do you have any questions for me before we start?
If I like want to retract something, how do you feel about that?
I feel great about it in the moment. That's totally fine. I'm less interested in like negotiating about it afterwards.
So if I say like, "Ack, I said that wrong. Could you edit that out and let me say it again?"
1000%. Yeah.
Okay, but I should. But I should do it in the flow.
If that's
not my gig. I'm not like.
I understand. If you call me tomorrow
and say, "Hey, there's this thing."
That thing I said.
So I would never ask you to edit this after the fact. And in fact, I've never asked anybody to edit anything after the fact, with one exception, which was when I was it must have been 2007, pretty early on at Politico, and Glenn Greenwald was convinced that we were a right-wing conspiracy. And he and I unwisely did a blog, and he'd been fighting on the blogs about it, and did a blogging heads debate. And in the debate, one of Glenn's proof points was that the guy who owned Politico, Joe Albritton, was somehow in his mind connected to the CIA. And he, in fact, ran Riggs Bank, which was this kind of bank that had some shady connections and was did, I think, things with Pinochet and stuff. And I said, Glenn, that may all be true, but, you know, it's his son, Robert, who runs the company. Joe is dead. And we moved on from there. I thought that was a pretty good rebuttal. And we moved on from there. And after the show, I Googled Joe Albritton. It turned out that he was not, in fact, dead, but,
no.
but was, in fact, the chairman of the company for which I worked. He has since passed away. But I then called Glenn and said, you know, I know that we are enemies, and but I think maybe I'll get fired. And would you mind if I just, like, insert an error? Because it was a thing where we each would upload our side of the video, and then they would sync them. Would you mind if I inserted an error here and kind of saved myself? Like, I did tell my editors, who I think were pained at this. But, yeah, and Glenn, who is, I wrote this recently, I mean, he's a huge asshole on the internet and incredibly gracious in person, was lovely and gracious about it and thought it was, you know, hilarious.
All right. Well, you can definitely, if you mourn anyone who's still alive in this conversation, we'll edit that out. That's fine.
That's all I ask. That's my only condition.
That's a fair game. Ben Smith, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for doing this.
Thank you for having me on.
I feel like it's going to be hard for you to turn off your phone. You strike me as someone who maybe it's going to be difficult to turn off your phone.
I've been trying hard over the last several years to be better about that with the help of my kids, so I think I'll be all right.
Are you good about it now?
I'm not good about it, but I do recognize that I have a problem.
But I feel like, yeah, you mean you just must be, that thing just must be like alive all the time, just like bouncing and dinging all the time.
I get a lot of email.
You get a lot of email.
Saying, yeah.
That is kind of what I'm saying.
Although also, I mean, I think when I started at BuzzFeed, I felt like I was like running the thing off my phone to some degree and editing stuff and emailing people all the time. And now we have so many strong editors and reporters, and I can like go away fishing for a week and the place is fine.
It's got to feel nice.
Scary, yeah. But nice.
It's scary to be like not totally vital all the time.
To not really be in charge. Yeah.
I want to talk to you about being in charge of BuzzFeed. But since this is a show ostensibly about writing, I feel like we should at least start with writing. All right, so you're running this thing. You're getting all these emails. You're making all these decisions all the time. You're hiring people, strategy, all that stuff. How do you decide when to write?
I mean, I guess I feel like if I don't have bylines, that I might not exist. I remember when I was working my first gig at the New York Sun, this reporter once said to me, you know, the way I feel is no byline, no me, which is there's that line about journalists being shy egomaniacs, and it's such a egocentric thing to say. And yet I do. If I don't write for a while, I start to get a little twitchy. So maybe that's just part because I've been doing it for so long. And right. I think I always, as a reporter for a long time, kind of tried to run at two speeds. You know, I'd be running the blog at this very high speed and then always try to have a back burner project.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think that, you know, as a reporter in general, like most of what we deal in is ephemera. And I love that. I mean, that's the business. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Like, in fact, I think that's a plus and something that you have to sort of, that shapes how you succeed at the job, but because you realize that this thing you're writing is about this moment and right now, it's and about its place in the conversation. It's not some piece of art to hang on the wall.
Right.
I think it's true of most journalism. And I think like the more you realize it, the more effective you're going to be most of the time.
The more you can keep that in mind, the better. Is that because the stakes aren't as high as they seem in the moment, or because if you can realize that like the conversation's going to change tomorrow and you're going to be a part of that, then you might as well not worry about it very much.
No, I think the stakes are higher in the moment. I mean, like, I think if you want to, like, paint a beautiful thing and hang it on the wall, the stakes are actually pretty low.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the stakes in terms of what will this piece do, you know, in terms of affecting people's lives, affecting politics, affecting the people you're covering, are usually higher than its aesthetic qualities.
So since the stakes are higher, it's good to remember that it's going to all change?
Well, I think, no, it's more that it's important to know what the stakes are. Like, mm-hmm. The stakes are about what this article is going to do, who it's going to affect. The stakes are not about whether you used an Oxford comma or not.
Right. Yeah, I feel like I was reading back through a bunch of your sort of early BuzzFeed interviews and stuff, and there was one where you basically said, like, Twitter was your copy editor for a while.
Oh, man. Shawnee Hilton, among other people, really shut that down. yeah, so I think that clean copy is one of the ways that you communicate seriousness and authority.
Mm-hmm.
And that I was a little slow to catch on to that and did for a while say to people, yeah, Twitter, it's great. They're free. They volunteer. They catch your errors. That was oversimplified. Because I had written a blog that I think was known, among other things, for its typos.
Right.
And I was always grateful to readers when they said, hey, asshole, you spelled this word wrong. I was like, thanks.
I admire your not worrying about that. Every time we get an email about a typo on the site, it's like 3 hours of
you,
shame.
You like, die a little.
Yeah. Well, we only put 11 words on the website every day. So if we get one of them wrong, that's kind of a
bummer.
And
we now publish really beautifully crafted features and investigations that have been, and we have an amazing copy chief.
We're getting down the weeds here on typos.
I get a little defensive.
Okay, so that I understand, right? Like, you were writing all the time for several years, and the idea of not writing at all makes you twitchy, break out in hives. But why do you decide to write the stuff that you write? So, I went back and looked through, just scrolled through your author page. And in the last couple of years, it felt to me like there's sort of three kinds of things you've been writing. One of them is scoops. Just flat out scoops, like the Uber one. You were at some dinner where
Emil Michael, he's a senior executive at Uber.
And basically said they're going to start going after journalists. You broke the still off the record Trump conversation at the Times. So that's one kind, is classic Ben Smith scoops. Those are still coming along and you're still doing those. And then you've been writing a lot about the industry, I feel like. You wrote a piece about what clickbait actually is. There was a sort of think piece about the state of long form, which we could talk about or not talk about. And the diversity policy you wrote, which I think is actually really fabulous and I would like to talk about more. And then there's this other kind of story, which we've linked to on long form. It struck me that you've written a couple of really long reported stories where you seem like you spent a lot of time on kind of lost men.
Yeah, that's really interesting because I have noticed that about what I write about too, and thought, I should probably write about some different things.
Well, you
too.
Wrote about Mickey Kaus, who was a sort of colleague of yours in the political blogosphere when that was more of a thing, and then Tom Lehrer, who were both kind of people who fell off the earth.
People whose work I loved, who sort of fell off the earth. I wrote a piece about two Palestinian, or not both Palestinian, but two Arab writers, Hussein Ibish and Ali Abu Nima, who I think in some ways a similar vein, who are these brilliant intellectuals who have devoted themselves to destroying each other.
I was interested in why those were the stories that you were this I'm going to carve time out of my crazy life to go and try and figure this out.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've always had two tracks, a fast track and a slow one. And I think if you look at the features I did at Politico, you'd probably find some more. I mean, I think there is a range, but I wrote a piece that I still really love about Richard Ben Kramer that was maybe a little in that vein. Yeah, this sort of nostalgic kind of piece about writers who I love. I don't know. Maybe it's just sort of that, but they do seem a little cookie cutter. So maybe I need to find something new to write about.
Oh, I don't think it's cookie cutter. I mean, one of the things that has come through on this show over and over again is people are often writing stories that help them figure out something they're trying to figure out.
All journalism is autobiography or alternately therapy.
Yeah. So I guess I was wondering, it kind of made me think, is this guy worried about falling off the face of the earth?
Oh, God. I definitely, I don't sort of so much worried, but journalism is just notoriously a difficult profession to grow old in.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure it's a fear or a, what's the opposite of a fear? Aspiration to just totally drop off the grid. Fantasy.
How old are you now?
39.
39. All of the profiles of you that I also read before we talked, they're all boy wonder.
Yeah, the Times used that headline, and I thought, man, that's the last time anybody's ever going to call me that. Because for a long time in your career, and I always tell this to our young reporters who are being in an article about young reporters and feel a little patronized by it, and I'm always no, that ends. the only thing worse than being kind of patronized as a wunderkind is when you're not.
Yes. Yeah, totally. Do you feel that transition is working out all right for you? Are you
I felt the whole thing, it's not that weird that you might be an editor in your late 30s. that doesn't seem that sort of, I don't think that I really count as a wunderkind.
Was that, but that that was perfectly easy for you to move post wunderkind?
I don't know. I never really thought about it much.
Okay. Do you miss reporting?
Yeah, I love reporting. And I still do it some,
right.
But I always whenever I get a chance, I love to. And, I had a lot of fun reporting out that Times tape thing.
I guess that's kind of what I was interested in, because like those scoop ones, they are exactly the kind of work that you were doing before BuzzFeed. And the ones that you have reported out seem to have made a huge dent. So like you must on some level know like, well, this one's really worth going for.
Yeah, yes. I mean, I do think I have a pretty good instinct for if you hear some little interesting bit of gossip, whether it's maybe more than an interesting bit of gossip, or if somebody says something to you that they might have thought was off record but wasn't, whether mm-hmm. whether it's news or not.
Being able to do that occasionally, does that basically scratch the itch?
Yeah, I think it does. And I mean, I love – the thing that I didn't really expect is I love working with reporters, like younger reporters or older reporters, and love sort of pitching in on stories and thinking about – how to cover. I mean, this is stuff I'd never done before. I'd never, you know, managed anyone or edited anyone, and was surprised by how much I liked it.
Do you think you're a good boss?
I don't know. I think sometimes maybe I'm a little hyper aggressive. I definitely have been told I should not stand behind people and bounce up and down on my and like my toes while they're trying to file and look over their shoulders.
I talked to some people who work for you who will remain nameless, but that was something that they brought up. Is like part of your management style is standing directly behind people.
Yeah. And I think I'm not a good, I'm not really a good story editor. We have some really wonderful story editors. Steve Kandel is a great, is really a great story editor in the sense of, and you know, Mark Schuf. There are a lot of people who are really just amazing story editors. And I basically have two settings. Like I can either tweak your lead and like, I can either like torque up the lead and add a few typos in the first couple paragraphs. Or I can totally rewrite the story from scratch in my own voice and be like, and then hit publish before you've seen it. but the whole thing of leaving notes in the margins and having a back and forth is something I never totally learned. And I also don't. I think after I get past 3,000 words, I start to lose a grasp of the structure of the story. As an editor, I can write longer, but it's and so when I see Steve and Mark and Ariel and Shawnee Hilton like work on these longer stories, I definitely like admire that.
Is that not a muscle that you wanted to get in shape?
I mean, I just not. I guess it's something I've never. I mean, I have done some of it, but it's not. But I think it takes a lot of practice to get good at editing really long story. To get good at seeing the structure and sort of understanding the structure of longer stories and books.
It's been 4 years, right? Like you just hit your 4 year anniversary.
More,
It's like high school, college. Like you're supposed to, like you know, 4 years is like a good period of time. I feel like
time to
like,
move on. Is that what you're saying?
No, I think it's like a time to kind of like look back. It's a good chunk of time. On the management side of things, not just editing stories, but like running and building this newsroom, like what have you learned?
A bunch of cliches probably, but just that like it's so important to hire the best people, and the difference between the absolute best, most driven people and the next tier is really large, and having people, you know, I just feel like the caliber of the people we've been able to attract, you know, in part by saying what the internet wants now is big stories, breaking news, you know, the things that journalists want to do, not filler, not kind of aggregation, is something that really, you know, great journalists are motivated by. And so I think people like Miriam Elder, like Mark Schuf, like Catherine Miller are just the absolute best in the game, and that in turn attracts the kind of the best writers. And I think like sort of really obsessing about how good the reporters and writers are we're attracting is really important.
What are you looking for? How do you make that call on whether someone's in that first tier or way down in that second tier?
You know, it's funny. Maybe this isn't a totally direct answer to the question, but sometimes journalism school, like, will bring their classes in or you'll talk to people who teach journalism and who ask sort of what skills we're looking for. And I'm really talking about reporters here. And we do a lot of different stuff at BuzzFeed. We make videos. We do a lot of entertainment content to which this particular thing doesn't apply. But they ask, like, what special skills or what traits are you looking for? And I think they expect the answer to be, like, well, we don't want people to be able to shoot video with their phones. And the thing is, like, everybody can shoot video with their phones. And, like, certainly editing skills are important, but you can learn editing skills, video editing skills. And anybody who is in college or in journalism school is on Snapchat, knows how to shoot video, is not going to learn in school how to shoot video, or maybe they will. But and I always say, like, you know, basically just raw aggression.
Raw aggression is what you're looking for.
Basically.
How do you find that in an interview, you know?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not that into interviews. I mean, I think you read people. I mean, the nice thing about this business is you can read people's – is that the work is all exposed. You don't have to guess what somebody's writing is like.
What does, like, raw aggression look like on the page?
I mean, it means that you're breaking story, that you're breaking news, that you're getting stories other people haven't gotten, that you're – I mean, that's really the core of it, right?
Yeah.
And also understanding how to present them in a way that makes clear what the news is and how they're news. It's a cousin to trolling.
How close have these 4 years gone to what your expectation was when you took the job?
You know, just totally different. Or at least I don't know if different. I mean, I didn't have very clear expectations, I think. I mean, it was a political cycle, and I'm a political reporter, and thought, oh, I could, like, hire a few people and we could cause some trouble in the campaigns. Mm-hmm. Like, we could do some good stories. We could make an impact. And I think Peter Kaplan had told me and had this theory that was really smart about how every campaign cycle, gosh, and now I'm trying to remember if this was Peter's theory or Ken Lehrer's theory. I heard it from both of them. But how every campaign cycle kind of both defines and is defined by a new media organization, and that was maybe CNN in 96. It was ABC's The Note in 2004. It was Politico and Huffington Post in 2008. And then in 2012, there was an opportunity to be that. And I kind of bought that and kind of saw it and thought, like, that could be us. And so and had enjoyed it at Politico, but definitely saw what we were doing primarily at first in terms of, like, okay, we have this, you know, really popular, amazing website that the kind of political class/elite are, like, either unaware of or mock. That's a huge asset. And then if you sort of yoke a political operation to that, you know, that's a very powerful thing. And then it was like, and then sort of, I think, learned from, you know, some of those early folks that I hired, Dory Shafrir and Matt Buchanan and others, about, like, trying to figure out how to do that in spaces that I didn't know as well.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly had, you know, I talked to Jonah, like, wow, I think there's really a space, like, as everybody has pulled out all their foreign correspondents, and yet there's this incredibly vibrant social media conversation that includes, you know, diplomats and heads of state and policymakers and journalists around foreign policy and around world news. Like, that would be a cool space to go into. And I remember, like, at the end of 2012, him saying, like, oh, remember when we were talking about that, those foreign correspondents, let's do that. And I was like, wait, really? We can do that?
Once the election was done, then you were able to start thinking about kind of, like, the wider array of opportunities?
Yeah, I mean, I think we felt like we had a lot of momentum. I mean, you know, and we also have a really effective business side. And, you know, I mean, it's like a lot, you know, I mean, there's no way we'd be able to do this much work if the company wasn't thriving.
How much do you think about the business side?
It's not my expertise or what I spend most of my time doing, and certainly, like, some of what I think about is, like, that an advertiser is calling me and yelling at me, and I'm saying, sorry, nothing we can do here. But I also want it to be a successful business and want to do what I can to make that happen. And so I do, I think I've, as we've grown, certainly thought about it more.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you, I'm sure, got some, like, equity when you took that job because it was a pretty early company. And I was just wondering, like, how much you're thinking about, like, BuzzFeed's value as it's going out and raising money from investors.
I still am not good at explaining that stuff to people. It's just not what I spend my time thinking about.
They don't bring you to those pitch meetings?
I've been to a couple pitch meetings, and I, like, you know, do my part, but I'm not going to explain to you. One of the most embarrassing things in my actually professional life, when I was a stringer for the Wall Street Journal in Eastern Europe, and I was stringing for the Wall Street Journal. I had gotten this job after a job at the Baltic Times. On my, like, third day as a stringer for the Wall Street Journal, I had to call up my girlfriend who was working in finance and ask her what the word equity meant. And she was like, wait, you work for the Wall Street Journal?
Don't ever tell anyone else that question.
It's just you, me, and...
Hey, I'm going to put things on hold for a second and tell you about a sponsor who's making today's show possible. That sponsor is Home Chef, and they can also make it possible for you to eat restaurant-quality meals at home super easily. They're going to send you fresh ingredients, step-by-step instructions. You can make every single one of their meals in under 30 minutes, and it's healthy. It's balanced. Here are a couple that you can try. Rustic vegetarian tart with spinach, roasted red peppers, and goat cheese. They got a maple miso glazed salmon with Brussels sprouts and apple, or a Parisian bistro steak with creamy potatoes and green beans. They got all the options you could ever want, gluten-free, vegetarian, low-cal, low-carb. Go to homechef.com/longform. That's homechef.com/longform. You get $20 off your first order, and you can start making these fantastic restaurant-quality meals at home. Start feeding yourself and your family better. Thanks, Home Chef. Let's get back to Ben Smith. I feel obliged to ask this since this is the Long Form podcast. How have the feature stories done for you guys? Like, Steve came on the show basically like the week he took that job.
In like late 2012, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that was another thing where it felt like, oh my God, we can actually do this. Like, it
right.
was after that first. And we had published some, certainly like long features, which I, and I remember actually Michael Hastings was like, you got to hire a real editor. Michael was an amazing magazine writer who died in 2013. But he would say, like, you got to get an editor here, like, because I would be editing him and I would just kind of like do a newspaper edit on it, which is you kind of brush it up and publish it. And there would be stuff in there. He's like, I only put that in there for you to take it out. Like, that's not even, you know, that was just like bait for you to take that out so you wouldn't take this other thing out. Like, he is coming from this very real editing process.
Right.
That
he, saw it as like the start of a long conversation.
Yeah, and I was just publishing. and so he was, among other people, really on me to get to hire a real editor. And that was Steve. And I think, you know, that was another place where we felt like at the time, and this is less true than it was, but that, but I still think there's just a huge space for it, that particularly at the time, though, there were two tracks for long features. Steve said this thing that I love, which is that with the word long form, that the stress is on the wrong syllable because they don't have to be long. And the idea that length is a goal is just makes me crazy. Or that anybody looks around and says, you know what, I want to read something long today. It doesn't have to be interesting or good. It just has to be long. Like, there is
for the
no
record, I don't think anyone has ever said that.
No, but I feel like the word and the emphasis on the first syllable implies that in some ways.
I actually think that's a straw man argument.
Or when I have writers sometimes say to you, what do you like to do? And I like to do long form. That's actually like a red flag for me.
Really?
Because it's like, well, I don't know. What story do you have? What are you interested in that merits that length? Like, I want to break news. I want to like tell great stories. But if what's the famous Hemingway thing? Like, if you can tell a story very powerfully and it can be short, that is preferable to telling the same story at 10,000 words. At the time on the internet, there were basically two categories of really long feature. One were beautifully crafted. You know, the writer got paid a lot. Lots of money went into it. Maybe a year-long, 6-month editorial process in Vanity Fair, The New Yorker, great magazines, that would then be put on the internet as an afterthought, if at all, like in some horribly unmanageable form where you had to keep clicking through or there were pop-ups or it wouldn't fit your screen. And then on the other hand, you would have things for which the writer had been paid $100 and had not been edited at all, which were often things that had been submitted to Process A and rejected and then kind of wound up on a website. And there was nothing in the middle. Like, there was nothing where a writer could be paid between like $2,000 and $6,000 and make a living, but not Vanity Fair money, and that would get really well edited and wouldn't be subjected to all the craziness of magazines where a story might get bumped month after month because it doesn't fit the mix of stories in that issue.
Mm-hmm.
And where you can't be opportunistic and say, shit, let's publish this thing now because it's of the moment. But nope, that's going in October. You know, like, there were all these handicaps and expensive handicaps that came with the magazine process, and we felt like, wow, what if we could take the best of that incredibly kind of rich, rigorous editing process, but ditch all the print centric restrictions, and that's really, and then be formally in formats. Just, I mean, in a sense, like at that time, it was pretty crazy just to not have page breaks,
right?
But incredibly valuable.
Yes.
And take advantage of the other elements, you know, be able to see where on the page people are dropping off. Be like, ah, looks like this is kind of got boring here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so we've been really thrilled with everything Steve's done. And it's, you know, it's kind of grown as we've grown. And as we've hired more and more reporters, it's shifted. We still take freelance, certainly, but we have more great staffers, you know, who are sometimes stepping out to write longer features.
Yeah, it seems like when it started, it was kind of like, I think it was Thursday nights.
Yeah, it's still Thursday nights. We're still publishing something Thursday nights, but it used to be essentially
ours. But there's like four or five other things that could be that week too.
We're publishing a lot of big features and big investigations, so it's less. In a way, that was our version of a Sunday magazine, and it was mostly freelance. And now it's shifted a bit, and we're doing more of it, but also more in house because we just have all these talented staffers. And we've definitely found also that you know the more you write for the internet, the more you learn about what the internet likes and what's going to work on the internet. And that's certainly true if you're publishing lists of, you know, gifs of people running into walls, a genre that I love and appreciate. And it's also true if you're writing long features. And if you care about the data and care about figuring out why people are sharing stuff, you do learn a lot. And so having people who are doing it regularly for us, you know, there's an advantage there.
What have you found about what works? Are there large conclusions you can draw after doing it for 4 years?
You know, I mean, some, right? Like, one of the things that works is novelty and surprise, and that's a hard thing to replicate. But I do think there are, You know, the stories people share and tend to be stories with a real emotional core, which is true of most good journalism, but not all. And I think there's a genre of magazine story that people actually don't really share that's like a perfectly, very specific genre, which is like, here's something you will never see anybody tweet, great yarn. You ever seen anybody tweet, great yarn, Link? And there's a kind of story that's about like a guy, about like men with guns who like running around, like maybe the middle of the country or maybe Florida, and they're like committing crimes, but they're kind of sympathetic, but they're like kind of goofy, and they are ultimately tragic figures and aren't really evil, but have maybe done some bad things. And like it kind of goes on, and it's kind of picaresque, and the characters are compelling, and it has no point, but it's like a classic magazine well feature, and nobody reads those on the internet.
Huh. I'm surprised to hear you say that.
I mean, it's just a fact. We've published our share of them, and I love that. I will read them when I have a magazine in my hand.
Oh, so you think people do read them in magazines?
Yeah, sure. I don't think it was a mistake for magazines to publish them. I think people just don't share them.
Why?
Because why would you share that? Like, it's not – people often share things because they have a point.
Mm-hmm.
Because they've, like, learned something. They want to, like, oh, my God, like, this incredible feature we published this week about how black drug dealers are getting shut out of the legalized drug trade while white drug dealers are being included because of the way the legal system has screwed them. Like, that was something where it's like, holy crap, look at this injustice. And that's a reason to share something. I think being moved by something or seeing yourself in it is a reason to share something. Just great story. This was a fun read.
Mm-hmm.
Is not a reason that people share things. Certainly, as a reader, if you start reading it, you can totally just get transfixed, you know, incredible narrative and, you know, read it, scrolling on your phone, standing stock still on the street. And this kind of story does that. But I guess I was wrong to say that nobody reads them on the internet. Nobody shares them. They don't travel.
That distinction sounds totally right to me. I mean, I actually, you know, happen to have like a pretty insane amount of data on this.
Yes.
And the gap between what people actually read and what people share is immense.
I also think, though, that part of the reason that the stories don't travel is that they are consumed primarily by men, and that women share more on Facebook in particular. And so stories that women don't share tend not to go anywhere. Stories that women and men like do well, stories that women like do well, stories that are really, I mean, yeah, it's, and this is obviously a generalization, and there are differences, but women have a lot of power in the distribution of content on the internet at the moment.
That's interesting. And that, I mean, though, that like paint by numbers crime story that you just described, that's the hallmark of the men's magazine.
It's straight out of a men's magazine. Yeah. If you think about the magazine brands that have succeeded on the internet, you certainly see more women's than men's magazines. Like if I'm looking at like Snapchat Discover, you know, I think like you see these Hearst magazines really doing well.
Yeah.
Cosmo.
Do you use Snapchat?
Some. The problem is I like it. I actually think it's, I mean, although it's like specifically designed to be like hard to figure out for people over 20. I know I really like it, but like my friends don't use it. Like I'm old and my social graph doesn't use it. I feel like there are all these messaging services that I kind of love. Line actually is one, and WhatsApp too. And because my sort of peers are like 40-year-old Americans, they use text and nothing else. And so I can't get anybody to like come over to Line with me. And so like Stacey Marie Ishmael uses it. So like she and I will line occasionally. And that's about it.
So this third kind of writing you've been doing, the kind of like, this is who we are. we can get off Lost Men. You didn't seem like you wanted to talk about Lost Men.
I'm sort of, you know, reckoning with my own pattern that you've recognized.
Sorry, we can talk about that later, or you can talk about that with your therapist or whatever. I'm sure you'll figure it out. The other thing you've been talking about, and the long form thing fits, you wrote a real treatise about that. You've taken the art of like the public internal memo to a new place.
I appreciate that.
One question is just how you think about that and that idea of transparency for your internal communication.
Oh, I've always thought like the best way to communicate internally is to do it externally. It's sort of harder as you get bigger. I was trying for a while to do all my internal communications on Twitter, like in at replies, just because the thing is, just internally, like I feel like it's really valuable if I'm having a conversation in the newsroom with somebody physically and everybody who overhears it knows kind of what you're thinking and knows how you're thinking and how we're approaching stories. And that's a really valuable way to communicate. And when we were a small number of people in New York, a very effective way to manage, and that is no longer true. And how to have that sort of expose your internal conversations to everybody in the company and to do it globally is tricky. And so I think that's one of the reasons. And I do think people are in some ways more likely to read something if it's published.
Mm-hmm. Your people are more likely to
read it? Yeah, I think people inside an organization in a strange way are in some ways more likely to read something if it's published than if it's one of a stream of internal emails that they're getting.
Does that philosophy carry over to other parts of managing like a large news operation?
I don't know. You don't. There's no. I mean, there's no point trying to keep secrets from reporters. Like, you know, I mean, you, I mean, there's. You know, the, I think that yeah, the more that you can expose, sort of. I mean, obviously there. Are, you know, we have this story coming. We're not going to tell you about it. Sort of secrets, but I mean, it also does allow readers and your staff to hold you to whatever you're trying to say, and it forces you to aspire to whatever you actually want to be. If that's
right.
What you're saying,
which is especially important when you're trying to figure out who you are and what you're doing.
Yeah, for sure. Although, yes, absolutely.
For sure, except what?
Well, I mean, I guess I'm getting a little abstract here, but you also can get boxed in by public pronouncements, and that's something that I also think about a little bit.
Have you gotten bitten by that?
No, actually, but it's something that I sort of occasionally have in the back of my head. If you know, if you say, well, we're going to do X, you then do find yourself thinking you ought to do X.
It was interesting, too, like when that Gawker went after you guys for the Pepsi thing.
Yeah, for deleting a couple of posts. I mean, that was definitely a place where we were like held to our, appropriately actually, held to our own standards. But I was sort of glad we were. I mean, in a way, that's what you have these standards for, so people can hold you to them. And that for me was a real learning experience around like, okay, this is no longer a small place where I should be like acting unilaterally. This is a place where we have a lot of people and rules and we all need to follow them.
And people paying attention. But it seemed to me like even the fallout from that and how you dealt with it was to try and be as transparent as possible. Like you invited Gawker to your office and had an interview, and they published like a pretty unedited version of that interview about it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I guess that's sort of the only way we know how to operate. Yeah, I mean, I guess we're learning. Like, I'm learning. Like, at some point, are you such a big company that you just have to like retreat into sort of like weird corporate silence? I don't know. We're not there yet.
Well, I mean, you guys are pretty big. If you haven't gotten there yet, maybe you don't have to.
Yeah, hopefully not.
I want to read your definition of diversity quickly.
Oh, sure.
And,
yeah.
And I'm interested in talking about that. BuzzFeed's working definition of diversity is this: enough people of a particular group that no one person has to represent the supposed viewpoint of their group, whether ethnicity, gender, sexual orientation, religion, gender identity, socioeconomic background, or disability. And if the group is a small one, we should never expect one person to be the diverse reporter or writer or to speak for anyone other than themselves. It's a pretty good definition.
Thanks.
You have this explanation of your diversity policy, and what follows is basically a business case for diversity.
I think there are a lot of different cases, but there is certainly a business case. And I do think that most industries, but like certainly the media industry, have always had this kind of high-minded and authentic liberal hope and commitment in some theoretical sense to diversity, and have wanted to be diverse places because they believe in it. And I think that has not proven to be totally effective as a way to get things done. And I think, you know, just the way the media has changed and the way the country has changed make it just like really sort of vital.
How so? I mean, just try and explain the way that you think about it.
In that piece, I sort of laid out several reasons, and I will now, a la Rick Perry, forget one of them. Well, they're the traditional ones. When you approach a story, you bring all your personal sort of baggage and history and language skills and perspective to a story, and having people coming from different places around any story is important. But I do think that that's always been true of reporting, and is, you know, truer and truer as the country becomes more diverse domestically. But I also think that the way the internet is structured is just deeply different from the way a print publication is structured. And if you have a magazine or a newspaper, you spend a lot of time thinking about your sort of median reader. Like maybe it's your magazine whose median readers are women 37 to 40 in metro areas with an income of X who are professionals. And if you're a big metro newspaper, you're thinking about the educated professionals in your metro area, or, you know, whatever it is. And I think that when you're online, it's each story is a magazine. Each story is its own publication. Each story has its own audience. And you're thinking more. And if you want to reach a mass U.S. audience, which we certainly do and are, you don't reach people necessarily by finding the lowest common denominator. Sometimes you reach them by finding the thing everybody has in common. Everybody is outraged by certain kinds of abuse. Everybody cares about cute animals. Like, they're universalizing things. And that's one way that you reach a mass audience, and certainly one way we do. But the other way, which is something that isn't available to print publications, is that you do stories that only some people care a lot about. You know, whether it's people who care about transgender rights, or whether it's people who, you know, which that's something where, and you know, a big story that is about a major outrage is interesting to everybody, but a scoop about the legal advances in that area might not be. You know, or Samir Mizrahi did this amazing thing about that really sort of showed this to me in some ways about growing up Persian in the United States, like things you only know if you grew up Persian. I think the deck was in Farsi. And, you know, parts of it were incomprehensible to me. But also it's sort of interesting to get a glimpse into somebody else's, you know, childhood. But it was, I think it was shared very, very widely in a community that was saying like, oh, wow, like this is really about like this is a publication that really understands Persian Americans. And I wonder what else they do. You know, I mean, that's sort of a nice way to introduce ourselves to people. I don't know. We did a How Bougie Are You quiz that, again, I may not have totally understood every bit of, but, you know, went really big for Black readers. And I think, you know, I think to have the freedom to say that not every piece is for the 51% majority of our readers, however we define that, but that we can really write for a Latino audience, for a Black audience in a very direct way. And we're not thinking about who is the BuzzFeed reader, who is the median reader, what's the average reader. That's not what we're, with every piece, sort of trying to target is pretty powerful.
Why do you think more places don't think of it that way? I mean, you know, I had Heaven and Tracy were in here.
Yeah, that was a great interview. Oh, my God, that anecdote Tracy told about our uncomfortable first lunch over terrible pizza was like just so totally accurate. But
I wish people could see how much you're cringing right now.
Excruciating to listen to. And I definitely did take her phone and read all the – she told me she had all these story ideas on her phone, and I did. It's like a classic thing I would do, just like take her phone and read them. But they were really good ideas.
Yeah, well, she's real good. But they did this thing where they asked – you know, a bunch of editors, a bunch of magazines about diversity and tried to get their definition of what diversity was. And a lot of it seemed to be that people were really uncomfortable even talking about it.
I mean, I think like liberal white people in America are really uncomfortable talking about race is certainly true. And I do think being able to have open internal conversations about race where people aren't totally on eggshells, where people feel like they're not immediately going to be pounced on. I mean, I think like the two dynamics that like shape a lot of American conversations about race are to some degree white people thinking that they'll be accused of being racist and tiptoeing and being terrified about that. But I think even more so, people of color worrying that they will be taken to be accusing someone of a racist if they say something critical. You know, and I think having a space where it's like, no, you can be critical without the other person becoming totally immediately defensive is important. But I think that's tricky. I mean, it's like tricky even to talk about. It's so easy to feel defensive about it or to like hurt your career or, you know, sort of be. And I think we've tried really hard to cultivate an internal environment where people feel like they can talk freely and where they can discuss these things.
So before this job, this BuzzFeed job, you were a political reporter.
Yes.
Political blogger for like, what, 10 years?
I started writing about politics in 2001, about U.S. politics, and I started my blog in 2004.
I have some just like very basic, we've not had a lot of political reporters on the show, and I have some very basic how to be a political reporter questions.
Yeah.
Here's the first question. How do you develop sources as a political reporter?
I mean, you go to bars and have drinks with people. I mean, in the very traditional way, right? I mean, also, though, I think one of the things when you're, I mean, there's a commerce in information. You trade information. I mean, particularly before the blog, you would sort of trade information with sources. Hey, I heard this. What have you heard? And then you would use that to try to build up to a story. And with the blog, it was like, oh, I'll just put all this out there, and then people will feel that I have been giving them information, and they will give me information back in sort of a free way.
And you were one of the kind of early people to do that, right? Like kind of break that rule a little bit.
Yeah, I had spent 2004 at the New York Observer reading these political blogs like Josh Marshall's and Andrew Sullivan's and some others and being kind of obsessed with them. And, you know, these Little Green Footballs, these conservative blogs had a huge impact. And thinking, wow, I wish there was one in New York because I was a local reporter in New York, and so started the first local one. And I think that was a moment when it seemed weird that you would take the tools of blogging, like reverse cron publishing and doing it really fast and without an editor, but with the sort of values of traditional reporting.
Mm-hmm.
And The Observer had this nice line between opinion and sensibility, and that you could sort of have a sensibility without necessarily having an opinion. And I felt like there was a space where you could have a sort of bloggy voice and a sensibility, but be fair and be professional.
Did you always have good fingertips for that like transactional nature of information? Like, I remember going out on stories when I was like a very young reporter and like – people were trying to like feed me things and I didn't realize it.
Yeah. No, you know? I guess inside politics, there's this whole permanent infrastructure of sources and transactions and stuff. And then there are a lot of good, you get a lot of good information. I mean, the thing is about information is who cares where you got it, right? I mean, if it's true, it's either true or it's not, and you should publish it. it's important or it's useful that you don't always know to understand the motive of the person giving you the information. But I kind of reject the idea that the motive taints the information,
mm-hmm.
you know, which is sort of the old criticism of opposition research. And there is a risk that you're being used by people. And then, of course, the best stories are the ones that, like, totally screw up that like, just mess that system up, that, like, that somehow, like, blow the whole thing up or cut against it in some way that is really – that makes a lot of trouble.
How so? Like, what are you thinking when you say that? What's a story that made trouble in that way?
I mean, I guess that Times story, right? Like there had been this carefully negotiated off-the-record thing between right. Trump and Times, and the only thing that perhaps was not considered was that these were human beings who might leak the fact of an off-the-record recording, and that Trump himself, if he wanted, could at least try to lift the off-the-record, and would he? And you can sort of suddenly that whole hermetic little moment
right.
breaks.
You could basically just by exposing the deal. You can break the deal.
Or you can put an enormous amount of pressure on what had seemed like a stable situation. I think good reporting often does that.
Are you still engaged in that kind of reporting? I mean, here you've got your next election.
I mean, no, mostly I am like watching the reporters on our team with awe. Like, you know, Rosie Gray and McKay Kaplan just did so much good reporting about Breitbart over the last week and, you know, got all these screenshots of their Slack conversation stuff. Andrew Kaczynski every day is blowing stuff up. Adrian Carrasquillo is sort of dug into Latino politics the way I always like. I never got as deep as he did, but like in terms of like trying to dig into Jewish politics, which is sort of what I grew up in a little, mm-hmm. and like, and then you can if you sort of dig into a niche, and that's a bigger niche, and you know, politics is composed of these elements, and if you can kind of take over one and own it and be the go-to reporter for it, you break news of importance to that community, and then also just news that's all you're just breaking news all over the place. And watching Adrian do that has been so fun. And mostly I just kind of like, you know, enjoy that and get to kind of like live in their reflected glory.
Seems like delighting in living in your employees' reflected glory is like a pretty good.
Yeah, you have to be. I do think that's pretty important to be able to enjoy that, it turns out. And I do.
Yeah, like you don't feel jealous of people being out on the campaign trail? Like, do you miss that?
Oh, yeah, totally. And I got to go out to Iowa, and that was a lot of fun. But, I mean, mostly I, like, will be, like, mumbling things to Catherine Miller, the political editor, and she'll be like, no, we're on that. We already made that call. Stop.
Got it. So, you know, like, Obama has that whole line about, like, all I do all day is just make the hardest decisions. Like, I just make the 51-49 decisions all day.
And, you
like,
ask me if I identify with that? No. My ego hasn't gotten quite there.
I was going to ask you, what are the decisions that you're making all day? If you came 4 years ago
right.
to define how BuzzFeed was going to cover an election, and now you've got a team of people who know what they're doing.
I mean, I think like most of the most important decisions are the longer term ones, like the decisions to hire Catherine and to structure the team in a way that was, you know, to a large extent her idea, but also mine and Shawnee's. And then, you know, these are decisions that you have to kind of stick with and watch them play out. So in terms of politics, like you're right. I think a lot of the decisions I make are sort of, you know, bets that you have to sort of stick with and then stand by your people and watch them play out. And so in a way, right, the most important decisions are decisions about hiring people and about sort of structuring your resources. But then I think I also get very involved in sort of in decisions around how to frame and time stories. Like I think that's something that I'm pretty good at,
mm-hmm.
Even if I'm not great at editing 5,000-word stories.
Do you spend a lot of time thinking about culture?
More than I would have thought. I mean, I came from I've worked in bureaus and out on my own in Brooklyn and not ever really been in the main newsroom. I've been like the city hall desk, and the culture of those sort of shared press rooms is its own weird thing where you learn how to talk on the phone without anybody knowing what you're talking about and stuff. And so the journalists I'd been close to were mostly competitors, not colleagues. But actually, I now do spend a lot of time thinking about culture, and it matters a lot. And I think one of the things, the really nice things about BuzzFeed's internal culture is that, I don't know, I have a lot of admiration for the people who do things that I'm not as good at. Like, I have done some, like, posts about identity and lists and fun and non-news stuff, but I find that harder. Although I hope you will read my list of things you only know when you're a geocacher.
We'll put it in the show notes.
But I find that stuff, you know, and I think that, like, there is an internal culture of, like, respect in which the folks who are doing the kind of stuff that gets you on podcasts like this and that gets external recognition, that gets fancy, you know, four-syllable words like journalism thrown at it, have a lot of respect for the people who are making really amazing entertainment and vice versa. And that's a cultural thing that I care a lot about, just that that, like, you know, Jen Lewis has made these unbelievable kind of vines about Donald Trump that are just, like, so hilarious. And she's just, like, this brilliant illustrator, basically. And that I think we have a culture of treating entertainment with a lot of respect. And I think that a lot of people who come from news don't. And that's a big that you know, both the content, of course, but also that culture is a real asset.
One thing that seems distinctive to me about what you guys have built is that people seem to ride for the place in a way that I don't see people doing at other places often. So, like, when BuzzFeed does something big, like that tennis investigation, it's like everyone I know who works there is like...
I know, and people, like, tweets it immediately, and people think, like, is this, like, a strategy? And I love the extent to which people are really invested in their colleagues' work. I mean, I do think it is about that rather than about us being like, all right, at 11:30 p.m., you will all tweet this with this language.
It doesn't seem that coordinated, but it does have this air of, like, scrappy underdog to be. Like, we need to ride for this thing. This thing needs
well,
to
we
be
are scrappy
for.
Underdogs. I mean, we're a lot smaller than, like, CBS News and NBC News and the New York Times.
Yeah, but you're no...
And Viacom.
Okay, so if your answer to we are scrappy underdogs because look at Viacom...
I think that's a reasonable answer.
Well, it says a lot about the ambitions for the place.
Yeah, I think that's true.
That's not who you would have been comparing yourself to 4 years ago.
It's probably who Jonah would have been comparing us to, but nobody would have believed him.
But that's where you think of, like, when you think of competition now, that's what you see as competition,
I mean,
is Viacom?
I think you're competing with everybody all the time, right? Like, we do lots of different things, and we have... And so each person at the company is, to some degree, competing with a different place. Like, I don't think there's one. Yeah, we have reporters who feel like they're competing every day with the guy from the Washington Post or the woman from the Times, and writers who are feel like they're competing much more with entertainment companies or mm-hmm. and people making videos, and the viewer of that video is choosing between something made by Disney and something made by BuzzFeed. Sure.
Are you like an inherently competitive person?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
How does that manifest itself outside of journalism?
I mean, I limped over here because yeah. I hurt myself playing tennis with my kid. Yeah, I don't know. I just tend to be pretty competitive about things.
Do you not
I
let
do.
Your kid win in tennis?
I do let him win. And it's increasingly, it's not a matter of letting him.
It seems like throughout your career, you sort of like tried to run at open spaces. So like there wasn't a New York City political blog. You did that. You were like early at Politico. You saw like an opening to cover the 2012 election, even like the conversation we were having about long form and how you were thinking of that, like finding that middle ground. Where do you see like the next hole? What's the next place?
I mean, there are always a lot
fill?
Of them. I think some of the video stuff that we and Zay Frank are doing out of LA are definitely kind of running into an open space. I don't know if you've seen Tasty, this food video, and this new one, Nifty, which is amazing, and DIY. And those feel like, again, like that, like have that sort of potential. I mean, for me, the thing that is most... It feels like a place where we are running into that is international. Like we have an incredible team in London. We have really strong teams in places like Paris and São Paulo, where I'm actually going on Sunday
nice.
To hire a news editor. And I think like both building real news operations, you know, around some of the stuff we've learned in New York, but also with really strong local people who are bringing their own media traditions in, is a huge opportunity for us. And that's something and then also we've seen the extent to which having this global network is incredibly powerful and having strong editors, you know, in Paris when those attacks happen. Or alternately, you know, when we break news about Twitter from our very strong San Francisco bureau, to have Alex Kantrowitz's story immediately translated into Japanese and go totally nuts on Japanese Twitter. It was really interesting and fun. And it just feels like there are huge opportunities there for us that are really interesting to pursue.
How did Twitter change your life?
You know, a lot. Like the thing is it basically killed the blogs. Like the kind of political blog I had been writing through 2008 was swallowed by Twitter. And then I mean, that's really the answer to that. In some sense, there had always been this inside political conversation that had been the boys on the bus in the 70s and conducted on the telephone and in emails and in like inside dope political columns and that then moved to the blogs and then very much to Twitter.
Are you on it all the time?
Yeah, but I am liking it less. I mean, it's just not as fun a place as it was. I feel like I'm not like meeting interesting people there as much anymore.
Do you think that's because people are just like crafting themselves on there more than they used to be?
Yeah, I don't really know why. It feels I think everyone, like a lot of people who adore Twitter are also a little tired of Twitter. I think they're struggling to balance, you know, these like very hard old questions about speech versus harassment, and you know the level of harassment on there is so awful, and they have to it's very difficult, I think, to how do you they obviously just need to figure out a way to make it a safer place, but then you know when the Republican presidential candidate is out there saying stuff that might in theory get you banned under some rule, like you obviously don't want to be banning important political speakers. I mean, how do you balance that? I think those are very hard questions.
It'd be pretty amazing if they banned Trump. Did you see this coming?
No, absolutely not. I mean, if you've covered New York politics in New York, you think of Trump as a joke. Like people in business in New York think he is a joke. He's not a real businessman. People who are in business think of Trump as somebody who plays them on television and like badly and are embarrassed by him. And he's talked about running forever, and everyone's always laughed at him. And we wrote and McKay Coppin sort of brilliant piece that sort of about that, about his sort of neurosis and insecurity and an amazing read, the absurdity of why he was running that I think that really got under his skin. He fired the guy who set it up and I think was one in a series of humiliations that prompted him to run.
Has he dealt with you guys at all?
Well, he trashed us from the debate stage, which is pretty great. He refuses to talk to us, but he is forced constantly to respond to our reporting.
Mm-hmm. Those political fights, that like back and forth, do you ever take that personally? Like even back when you were blogging and stuff, like did it ever feel personal or did it always feel like a game to you?
Oh, yeah. No, I feel like anybody who's been on social media and had somebody attack them very intensely, well, sometimes it just gets so far under your skin and suddenly like your heart is racing and you're sweating and you're like, and I think I have like a very thick skin and have partly just because I've been through so many cycles of this. But yeah, there's no way to not take it personally sometimes. I mean, it is personal.
Have you always had a thick skin though?
I think it's something you develop.
All right, actual last question. I feel like I've said that to you like four times, but this is the actual last question.
Now I've actually called the Uber. So.
All right, okay, we're done. Except that here's my question, and it's along the lines of the thing that you seemed most eager to talk about in this interview, which is the like Max reads your writing and tries to figure out your psychology part of it.
Oh, yeah.
These like disappearing men stories. Do you have some fear that this stuff is going to pass you by?
No, it's not. I don't think it's something that I spend my time thinking about or worrying about. I mean, I do think that at any point in this kind of media environment, or at least in the media environment of the last 10 years, you have the opportunity / risk of just like leaving it. It's just changing so fast. And I think actually, I think that you see Lost Men, you see that with Jeb Bush. He's a guy who sort of stepped out of, and politics is the media, there's no real difference. He stepped out of a political media environment in the early 2000s. And came back to what he thought was the same environment. It was just totally changed. He was a visitor from a lost world.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's not something that I like fear. I mean, it's definitely something that someday sounds kind of nice.
There's something kind of appealing in that.
Yeah, for sure.
Getting off the race. Ben, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Longform. I'm Max Linsky. My co-hosts are Aaron Lammer and Evan Ratliff. Our intern this week was Courtney Harrell. The show is brought to you by MailChimp, Harry's, and Home Chef. Start making restaurant-quality meals at home in under 30 minutes. Go to homechef.com/longform. You get $20 off your first purchase. Thanks very much, of course, to Ben Smith for taking the time to tell you guys he limped into this office. It was a trek to come to Dumbo, and I appreciate it. We'll see you next week.